3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
Five, four, three, two, one.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
Welcome to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. My name's Ian McIntyre. The first talk we'll hear today is given by Michael Pearson, who is a PhD candidate at the Australian Catholic University. It concerns the first motor mechanics and their connection to class labour and technology in early 20th century Australia.
My talk today is an adaptation of the first chapter of my PhD thesis, which is seeking to explore the development of the motor mechanic trade in Australia over the 20th century. By the 1920s, both certification and technical education of the motor mechanic trade had been introduced by motorist organisations. But in the trade's formative years, things were more ad hoc. Mechanics did not require certification, and many did not even have formal training in fixing cars. How did the trade transition from such an informal state to something more structured? And why was this controlled by motorist groups and not by the mechanics themselves? I hope to answer these questions today by exploring how the trade developed over the first two decades of the 20th century through following the beginnings of the motor mechanics trade from the arrival of the automobile in Australia. The introduction of the car in Australia was part of a wider transformation of transport and roads, an ongoing revolution which historians such as Lester Hovenden date back to the 1880s with the introduction of the bicycle. The first cars arrived in Australia at the turn of the 20th century, appearing on Australian roads in the 1890s as a result of individual Australian enterprises. These were smaller, usually backyard ventures, and were quickly overtaken by the already established international car market as cars transitioned from an engineering novelty into a growing transport industry. Historians Robert Conlon and John Perkins cite a French De Dion motor car imported into Sydney in 1900 as the first imported car to reach Australian shores. But by 1907, around 3,559 automobiles were imported into Australia from Europe and the United States. Cars of the early 1900s were an elite status symbol and a technological toy. Even after the introduction of Ford's Model T revolutionised the car market in 1908, by providing a relatively cheap yet reliable option for motorists, the purchase price was £250, not including further operational and storage costs. This brought the price down to fit into the ranges of professionals and farmers, but for the blacksmith or fitter, who in 1907 was making £2.14 a week, the idea of owning a motor car remained a pipe dream. But these earliest cars were fragile by modern standards. Breakdowns and problems were common. Compounded with Australia's harsh conditions and, in particular, our notoriously bad roads, cars required almost constant maintenance. If motorists were lucky, they would know someone with the mechanical knowledge to keep their car running. Otherwise, they would have to seek help from whoever might have the skills, or at least the ingenuity, to get their car back on the road. So who were the first mechanics? In Australia, labour and automotive historians alike have so far drawn a fairly straight line between the metalworking trades and motor mechanics. Tom Sheridan, in his History of the Amalgamated Engineering Union, describes motor mechanics as the direct descendants of engine fitters. And while there's truth to this, as blacksmiths and fitters especially were drawn to automotive repair work, they were not the only ones. Mechanics came from a wide variety of backgrounds, often either in the metalworking trades or engineering, but there was no one path to becoming a motor mechanic in the early years of the 20th century. With no technical training available for mechanics at the time, the two main ways of learning the trade were through books or simply through doing. The earliest manuals, such as Dyke's Motor Manual or the British Repair Manual, were colossal books that contained a breathtaking amount of information relating to the inner workings of almost every car available in Britain and the United States during the early 1900s and 1910s. But these were large and expensive books. More often, mechanics got their start by simply starting. Shane Burney has previously noted that often the only change a blacksmith underwent to become a mechanic was simply changing the sign on the door. The Australian development of the trade mirrors its development within the United States. Kevin L. Borg, an American historian of technology, has written previously of a similar transformation of ad hoc mechanics from a variety of different areas of work into something resembling an automotive repair trade. But, as in the United States, this transformation was not straightforward. In his book Auto Mechanics, Borg cites a New York blacksmith who warned that the automobile trade compared with the blacksmith trade is like a watchmaker compared to a toolmaker. Not every blacksmith could become a mechanic, but not every mechanic was necessarily a blacksmith or a metalworker. Even transitioning between blacksmithing and mechanic work was not necessarily straightforward. Blacksmiths would add automotive repair work to their list of services rather than transitioning away from their original trades. And this type of fluidity between work is seen in other trades that took up repair work as well. Charles Kellow, the owner of one of Melbourne's earliest garages, was originally a bicycle dealer who began importing motor cars as a way of standing out from other bicycle shops. The popularity of automobiles encouraged him to transform into a garage, and as early as 1903, he was advertising his expert mechanics as a way of assuring his customers that his business was equipped to handle their repair needs. Yet, the mechanics within Kellow's garages were almost certainly either adapted bicycle mechanics or young engineers. This touches on a key feature of the early development of the trade. People were often called upon to become mechanics out of necessity, and many became motor mechanics before they even knew it. In June 1905, Mark Foy, a noted sportsman and department store owner from Sydney, was driving through the small town of Grafton in northern New South Wales when he had an accident. Foy was travelling with his wife and chauffeur and was undertaking a tour of regional towns to recover from health issues. With his chauffeur unable to solve the problem, Foy turned to the people of Grafton for help and was eventually pointed towards Monty Page, a town tradesman. Page was able to repair the car in only a few hours, and Foy was so impressed with Page's work that he offered him a very tempting offer on the spot to run a fitting shop that he was seeking to establish back in Sydney. The Grafton Argus were outraged by Foy's offer, announcing that if Page accepted, their newspaper will consider they have a big grievance against Foy, because Page was often used by the newspaper to fix their own printing machinery when things went wrong. Monty rejected Mark Foy's offer to move to Sydney, and instead, seeing the promise in automotive repair work, opted to set up his own motor mechanic workshop in Grafton. Now, Page was one of 11 siblings, and the reason we know so much about them is because one of them was Earl Page, a doctor in Grafton during the 1900s, but later leader of the Country Party and Prime Minister. Earl relied heavily on his brother's knowledge and skill to keep his 1904 Rover, used for making house calls, and later his 1908 Italia, used for political campaigning, running. In his autobiography, Earl gives praise to his brother for keeping him on the road during these early years, and I quote, "Without my brother Maund, as he calls him, I should have been in dire straits often. His relationship to mechanical contrivances paralleled my facility in medical and surgical affairs. When he diagnosed a disease of automation, he displayed a sixth sense, and when he operated, he did so with precision. He was naturally sensitive to the peculiarities of mechanical intestines, and when most modern knowledge and experience failed to solve his problem, emulated Professor Mills and invoked the old. What he could do with a piece of fencing wire in an automotive emergency filled me with wonder and admiration." And I wanted to highlight this passage particularly as it makes an incredible statement of how mechanics were perceived in the early days of motoring. Part of this is surely that the future Prime Minister is being grateful to the times that his brother got his car started again in a thunderstorm. But there's a genuine wonder at the skills that mechanics possessed. To Earl, Monty is not just a grease monkey, he's a doctor of machinery. And Page's story highlights the social fluidity of motor mechanic work during this period. The status of cars, combined with the nature of work, created a time prior to the formalisation of the trade where mechanics appeared from a whole host of backgrounds, from blacksmith sons to doctor's brothers. I want to jump forward a little bit now to look at another interesting element of the fluidity of the trade in its early years, which is the involvement of women, especially during and following the First World War. With the lack of requirements for formal qualifications or even training, this allowed women like G.M. Cameron an opportunity to become mechanics, and I'll expand in a bit why the lack of formal training was important. Cameron boasted to the Sydney Morning Herald that, "I can't make a bed, I'd ruin a dinner and burn a kettle of water. I can't sew, nor bake, nor sweep, but give me a garage full of mixed cars, my overalls, and a kit of tools, and the world is mine." While the earliest examples I've found of women working as motor mechanics in Australia come during the First World War, the media response to women mechanics during the earliest years of the trade gives an interesting insight into the way the modern nature of the car plays into the understanding of the work related to it. A 1902 article in the Adelaide Register claimed that the motor has brought in its train an opening for intelligent women with a taste for mechanical engineering, and there are many more of this type than some people would imagine. Cameron and her other contemporaries seem to be a fulfillment of this initial understanding. The Sydney Sun dubbed Cameron Miss 20th Century, and she subsequently appeared in a number of advertisements. It's important to clarify, though, that women like Cameron were the exception rather than the rule. Women, then as now, were not working as mechanics in massive numbers, but they were there, and the possibility of engaging in mechanical repair work was there also. Alice Anderson, the most famous female mechanic, only hired female apprentices in her Melbourne garage during the 1920s. Now, providing an exact number of how many motor mechanics existed in Australia during this period is pretty much impossible. The 1911 Australian Census counted a combined 3,630 automotive and bicycle mechanics, the majority of whom were based in New South Wales and Victoria. 10 years later, this figure had expanded to 11,251. A large explanation for the rise in these figures is the increasing popularity of the motor car and the creation of training programs post-World War I for returning soldiers. But it's not certain whether these figures correctly identify people who had the skill and ability to work as motor mechanics and even carried out work in these areas, but may not have necessarily defined themselves as a motor mechanic first and foremost. And this confusion over who was and was not a mechanic resulted in a larger issue for the trade. The blending of mechanic work in these early days in amongst other motor, engineering and metalworking trades made it difficult for the motor mechanic trade to establish itself internally. There were a few trade unions that formed to represent mechanics, but these were small and often short-lived. The Motor and Cycle Mechanics Union, formed in Adelaide in 1908, is the earliest union for mechanics that I've found, but they only lasted around 6 months. In Melbourne in 1913, the Engineers and Mechanics Independent Union held 105 members, while the Chauffeurs and Motor Mechanics Independent Union contained 39 members, but both of these seem to have disbanded with the outbreak of the First World War. It was not until the formation of the Amalgamated Engineering Union in 1920 that mechanics were represented nationally by a union. And while the demand for automotive repair work grew, there was little leadership that emerged from within the trade itself. And this created a vacuum, which allowed those from outside the trade to fill the void. Unlike motor mechanics, which remained unorganized throughout the first 20 years of automotive repair work, motorists were quick to define who they were and organize themselves and emerged as the main controlling groups in the automotive industry in Australia. From the earliest days, motorists developed a culture that promoted unity among car owners and a sharing of knowledge amongst their established elite. The establishment of car clubs, such as the Automobile Club of Victoria in 1903, ran car meets and races that allowed motorists to socialise, network and, most importantly, organise. These motoring clubs established themselves quickly. By 1905, motoring clubs were founded in every mainland Australian state. And these clubs were, by definition, elite organisations. With only the most affluent people able to afford cars, the ACV, as an organisation, was essentially able to organise the elites of Melbourne around issues affecting automobiles. They tapped into existing networks of influence and they quickly gained power by asserting themselves as experts in automobiles and a body that represented the political will of motorists. These organisations sought to use these established networks to place themselves as leaders of the emerging motor industry. Motorists made themselves the experts, despite the lack of expertise. But as they were organised and easily identifiable, they were consulted by governments to help introduce policies and laws relating to cars. These organisations also published journals, which encouraged their readers to learn how to repair their own cars, while simultaneously denigrating those who worked as a motor mechanic for a living, rather than repairing their own cars as a hobby. One letter to the November 1909 edition of the Australian Motorist was horrified at one day pulling up alongside a car that was driven by two rough-looking youths, displaying oil and dirt-stained arms and vest, and their old pants or blueies in contact with the seats. Next to this letter are instructions on how motorists who had the ability to house their car at home could build their own repair kit to conduct all maintenance required at home. The attempt here was to remove the respect given by people like Earl Page. Mechanics weren't automotive doctors, but grease monkeys, with the aim of denigrating the mechanic's skill to both lower their status and undercut their emerging trade. Mechanics weren't the only target of this tactic. Motorist organisations were successful in doing this with private chauffeurs. By 1911, the Sydney Morning Herald was informing readers that a man with average intelligence will be able to drive exceedingly well in a few weeks and driving as well as a professional chauffeur in a few months. But in contrast to chauffeurs, getting motorists to undertake repair work was difficult. Driving was an accessible and relatively easy to learn skill, hence why motorists were able to adapt to undertaking driving themselves. There were multiple barriers, though, in the way of turning all motorists into mechanics. The first was a simple lack of knowledge. Even being able to identify easy-to-repair problems compared to more complicated issues was a skill in and of itself. Journals, newspapers, and manuals could educate drivers on how to undertake minor repairs, but the new wave of mechanics, and especially those emerging from metalworking and the engineering trades, had an inherent advantage over motorists. The mechanics who engaged in automotive repair work were using existing knowledge from previous working backgrounds that could be adapted to automotive repair work, even if this knowledge wasn't directly related to automobiles. Motorists, generally professionals with little hands-on experience, were often learning everything from scratch. Because of the nature of the work motor mechanics were engaged in, mechanics were able to survive and thrive into the 1920s. But because of their fractured nature, they were unable to organise their trade. Rather than denigrating mechanics, motorist organisations switched tact and used their established status to impose themselves at the head of the trade. They did this through the organisation of technical education and also through certifications following the end of the First World War. This would bring about an end to the fluidity of the trade in its embryonic years as it became established. As cars became a common sight, the trade became formalised, regulated and controlled. And this formalisation helped to assert barriers of entry into the trade, restricting those who did not fit the mould of who a mechanic should be. An example of this was using technical education as a way of imposing traditional work boundaries by separating learning for personal use and learning for work. Swinburne Technical School created specific women's motor mechanic classes in the late 1920s, but these courses did not give women the qualifications to enter into the trade. These barriers were not complete restrictions. Places like Alice Anderson's garage allowed for women to enter into an apprenticeship, which Anderson bragged gave a better all-round education than the top technical courses. But it was clear that the era of fluidity of a trade that challenged social boundaries around work was at an end.
One fine morning, I woke up early. Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Bella Chow. One fine morning, I woke up early to find the fashions at my door. Oh, Partigiano, please take me with you. Bella Chow, Bella Chow, goodbye, beautiful. Oh, Partigiano, please take me with you. I'm not afraid anymore. partigiano. Bella ciao, goodbye beautiful. Bury me upon that mountain beneath the shadow of the flower. So are the people passing. Bella ciao, goodbye beautiful. So are the people passing, and say, oh, what a beautiful flower.
Listening to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. You just heard Mark Rabeau and Tom Waits' version of the Italian anti-fascist song Ciao Bella. Prior to that, we had a talk from Michael Pearson about the first motor mechanics and their connection to class, labour and technology in early 20th century Australia. Our next talk comes from Dr. David Faber, adjunct senior lecturer at Flinders University and the vice president of the South Australian branch of the Australian Society for the Study of Labour History. His talk outlines the history of the Wheels disease strikes of 1934 to 1935 in tropical North Queensland. It looks at the involvement of Communist Party of Australia members, activist lawyer Fred Patterson, and Italian anarchists and anti-fascists, such as Francesco Giovanni Fantin.
Safety first. The 1934 Ingham virus disease strike. University of Adelaide historian Rob Norris trained his students to begin their inquiries by reviewing the secondary literature. It was as well, he taught, to be orientated as to what researchers had previously made of the available evidence before dividing into primary sources and seeking to discover new ones and interpret the field anew. This paper will accordingly begin by teasing out the traces of the 1934 Ingham Wilds dispute disease strike, embedded in the principal historiographical interpretations of the dispute over health and safety during 1934 and 1935 cutting seasons on the tropical North Queensland Sugar Coast. The two principal scholars who have most significantly contributed to our understanding of these strikes in the early 1980s were the late Diane Mendetti and subsequently Gerardo Papalia. In 1994, Fedora Gould Fisher contributed some pertinent pages in her biography of Sir Raffaele Cilento. In 1995, further details in historical context of the industrial disputation in the Ingham, Victoria and McNaid mill areas during the 1934 season emerged in William A. Douglas's From Italy to Ingham, Italians in North Queensland, published most appropriately by University of Queensland Press. The emphasis on the 1934 Ingham strike, which followed the appearance of the disease in 1933 in the district, is justified in that it prefigured the organisational resourcefulness addressing the health and safety issues which led to the 1935 regional strike, which invested virtually the whole of the North Queensland cane fields. The 1934 strike is also an important episode in the history of the relationship between state and society in Queensland, not to mention the inner workings of the labour movement. The ALP MLA for Mackay, Premier Fulton Smith, aligned with the dominant Australian Workers' Union faction, gambled that the exceptional climatic conditions of 1933, which incubated the disease, would not repeat in 1934 and undermine a major industry on which a depleted treasury depended. It was forced by the fresh outbreak of Viles' disease to deploy all his political influence with the AWU and send in police to repress the strike, which broke out with the advent of the 1934 crushing season. The 1934 Ingham campaign was a short, sharp affair which gained its immediate objectives. Court orders were obtained to burn cane fields to drive out rodent vectors infecting the fields. Industry interests, however, undermined the industrial truce to which this temporary victory had given rise by contesting the burn orders. Furthermore, Mengetti, in the 1983 monograph of the 1935 strike, noted that the 34 strike remained undocumented. While references in Douglas' subsequent study on Italian settlement in North Queensland qualify this remark, there remains a need to bring about the threads of discussion, to bring together the threads of discussion about the 1934 strike. It would be as well to detail what the Wiles disease strikes were about. Wiles disease is a fever occasioned by the bacterium Leptospira icterohemorrhagae, a pathogen isolated by Japanese scientists in paddy fields. It manifests around the world in the damp and dirty environs of battlefields, mines, sewers and fisheries. It was named for its clinical discoverer, a German military physician who diagnosed it in the Balkans in 1875. The melancholy visitation of the malady was first diagnosed on the sugar coast at Ingham by local general practitioner Dr. Gordon Morrissey, who heroically managed an outbreak during the 1933-34 cane crushing season and went on to campaign with the covers for its eradication. The rainy season that year had been particularly wet, and rodents had accordingly bred prolifically in the sodden soil. The rat population grew to plague proportions of up to 3,000 individuals per acre. These vermin excreted the pathogen, defecating and urinating. When the cane was cut, the exposed limbs of the cutters were lacerated by the fibrous cane trash, inoculating them. Between the opening of the harvest prior to October 1933 and February 1934, Morrissey treated 40 cases, diagnosing the condition in advance of laboratory tests on the basis of the strikingly similar clinical picture presented by all cases. Chills at onset were quickly followed by fever, intense headache and generalised body pain, and malaise so severe that most victims presented on the second day. The observant Dr. Morrissey noted a furry, coated tongue and enlarged glands in the armpits, bloodshot eyes and a dull expression with extreme mental depression at the onslaught of the infection. Intense thirst and loss of appetite were also observed. The condition of the majority of 24 cases, treated to some good effect by nursing, bed rest, saline solution and glucose, improved over 5 days, but all were very shaken men for many weeks, during which some were unable to work. Permanent debilitation was feared by some. In the remaining 16 cases, however, a deterioration was noted, with jaundice appearing. All these patients exhibited tenderness over the liver and spleen. Vomiting was general, in some cases intractably, and the vomitus contained black blood. An ill omen for some was hiccuping. Nosebleeds and bleeding gums and some superficial bruising were noted. 4 of these patients exhibited muttering delirium and died. Those who experienced the very severest form of the disease were thus died at a rate of 25% of cases, which gave rise to a popular rumour that that was the rate of mortality associated with all cases of the disease. So there was a great fear abroad on the cane fields. The other 12 made slow recoveries, the return of appetite being marked by a craving for fruit. All patients were men who worked in the cane fields as cutters or farmers. The outbreak of 1933 and 34 had apparently been heralded by unseasonal downpour followed by a short, dry incubation period. Fearing a recurrence in the wake of the ensuing wet season, Dr. Morrissey notified the Queensland Health Department. As Morrissey later reported in the Medical Journal of Australia, on 26 June 1934, the recurrence duly appeared, lasting about 3 weeks. There were 32 cases, all reminiscent of the first outbreak. Four became jaundiced, and two died. Local circumstances, industrial, economic and hygienic, called for expedition, which was entirely forthcoming in response to the first outbreak of any importance of Viles disease in Australia, substantially affecting an England cane workforce of about 800, overwhelmingly Italian and 90% AWU members. About 10% of this workforce were infected in a further outbreak of the disease in August 1934, when 80 field workers were stricken over 10 days. Although these first outbreaks were confined to the Ingham district, terror stalked the entire Sugar Coast in the form of a localised great fear of a sort of plague, laying the basis for industrial confrontation in 1935 when outbreaks spread to other districts. In April 1930, the international communist movement was about 2 years into Stalin's class against class third period. It simplistically demonised social democrats as lower middle class social fascists, deceiving and betraying the working class by pandering to the bourgeoisie. The unions and petty bourgeois democrats were mere tools of a reactionary ruling class. In that month, April 1930, the CPA directed proletarians to rise in a general strike. The party didn't believe in the realism of this call and the masses themselves were unmoved. This was explained away as a function of the peddling by the ALP of reformist delusions. By the time Gittel was elected Chancellor in Berlin in 1933, the CPA was showing subtle signs of wavering in commitment to this line, reflecting a hankering among some like Fred Patterson in North Queensland for a less abrasive doctrinaire approach. In 1931, after the Conservative triumph of the December Commonwealth election, the need for strategic readjustment to build a united front was belatedly recognised in Australia. This was in advance of its declaration in Europe. The adjustment was received with some relief by CPA rank and file. The front coincided with observed membership growth and electoral support. 10,254 electors voted communist in Queensland at the September 1934 Commonwealth General Election, just a fortnight after the apparent resolution of the Ingham strike. If this was only half the social credit vote, it was nonetheless a good showing for an activist leftist minor party. But the United Front was popular in its breadth of appeal and well suited to the situation on the ground in North Queensland. Communist comrades appreciated the opportunities presented by making common cause and building support around issues in the community. It was an idea whose time had come. Industrial and political networks would be rebuilt. In North Queensland, communists eagerly seized the new season of party growth and influence. It's clear that local branches of the CPA, led in the main by sugar workers, provided primary infrastructure for the active popular mass community response to the health and safety crisis. CPA branch structure and leadership on the Sugar Coast was well articulated locally, providing the structures that supported all aspects of the strike, from instigation to sustaining a diverse support base buttressed by effective party strike relief, often inspirationally led, to quote the novelist Jean Devaney, by strikers' wives, quote unquote. While Devaney's feminist empowerment and consciousness raising in strike support work was a feature of the 1935 dispute, it would be strange if England women had not, to some extent, performed a fairly traditional but radicalising function as for women's auxiliaries in 1934 strikers. The Ingham strikes is built on the reorganisation of the CPA in North Queensland. Prior to 1933, the party was divided into districts rather than states, with North Queensland subdivided off as a section. In 1933, to accommodate growth and autonomy, The regional organisation was upgraded to a district, headquartered in Innisfail, and initially staffed under a central committee by unemployed and underemployed during the sugar slack season. The organisation grew from just over 50 comrades in 1932 to some 600 before dispersing with the outbreak of war in 1939. Reorganisation, it would seem, had been effective. Leading party personnel were distributed throughout the sugar towns and hamlets. Key individual in this growth was the skilled regional advocacy of Frederick Woolnorth Patterson, a former Queensland Theological Rhodes Scholar, secularised and radicalised by his experience of the Great War, who set up a legal practice in Townsville in 1933. By December 1934, he was building up a clientele amongst the Italian community by successfully defending, before a hostile magistrate and a friendly wharfy foreman of the jury, Frank Carmagnola and Marco Tagliani from well-founded charges of having assaulted the fascist Italian Consul General Agostino Ferrante at Ingham. Subsequently, Patterson was retained by a leading Meridian Italian Progressive Club exponent, Luigi Danese, to advocate against British preference for the High Court. British preference was a policy of reserving cane industry jobs to Anglo-Australians at the expense particularly of Italians. The concern of the Italian community at Ingham and in the north more generally revolved from British preference to the Wiles disease, both material occupational concerns. In the 1935 strike, the response of the Italian community impressed Jean Devaney with its effectiveness and discipline. Since the preceding Ingham strike attained its immediate objectives, it must be supposed to have been very similar in this regard. Carmagnola comrade, the anarchist anti-fascist activist Francesco Giovanni Fantin, was an associate of Costante Danese, the brother of Luigi Danese. In the interwar period, immigration restrictions brought in by the Nationalist Police Administration against communists and anarchists were but loosely policed. Such was the demand for cheap white labour, particularly Italian, in the North Queensland cane fields. This altered the demography of the sugar coast, making it an unintended regional testing ground for cultural diversification, generating serious ethnic and industrial tensions. These were most evident in the long-running controversy over British preference, which I've just mentioned, which was brought in by an understanding known as the Gentlemen's Agreement between the Australian Workers' Union and cane-growing interests in June 1930. Over 233 heterodox Italian subversives, or subversivi, mostly anarchists and their connections, came into the country during the Italian fascist era between the wars. There is evidence of anti-fascist retribution in North Queensland as early as 1925 against fascist compatriots for the exile of the anti-fascists at the hands of Mussolini's Final Solution for Dissent. Disdained by the politically and organisationally demanding Marxist leader and philosopher Antonio Gramsci as quote-unquote gypsy bands, the political irregulars incapable of breasting the fascist tide in Italy, they were nevertheless to demonstrate, despite their shortcomings, considerable organic cultural and organisational capacity in Australia, most significantly in collaboration with the CPA on the interwar sugar coast. Some of this political capacity was productively applied industrially during the Wiles disease dispute. Indeed, the 1934 strike was materially assisted by Italian cutters, not to say led by them, and they were led by Veneto anarchist Francesco Giovanni Carmagnola, who had a friend who oral sources say campaigned beside him in this strike, and that was Francesco Fanti. He was supported by IMCO national Mario Cazzolino and Pat Clancy. Both Cazzolino and Clancy were CPA members, and also noted as the effort of the Penner family. Conflict between strikers and police drafted in was willing. At Bemerside, near Halifax, police dispersed the strikers' assembly, drawing their batons and using them freely according to official report. There is an oral tradition descended from Carmagnola by his younger comrade Fabio Cavadini, that one of the police objectives at Bemaside may have been to decapitate the Ingham strike by arresting Carmagnola. This supposition is at least very plausible, given the known police concern about quote-unquote Carmagnola's forces, estimated at some 200 strong, which operated flying squads taking direct action throughout the Ingham district, overturning trains of cane, cutting violation of the strike, and persuading strike-breaking cane gangs to desist. The 1935 strike evolved from the unravelling of the 1934 Ingham settlement, when the industrially worsted employers resorted to class lawfare to overturn the General Byrne order, which had resulted. At this stage, prior to the Union's 1935 anti-communist about-face, AWU official and rising star Clary Fallon represented, with the assistance of a Dr. Cotter, a medical scientist, as an expert witness, the men in the industrial court against the application of the Colonial Sugar Refining Company Limited, the Queensland Cane Growers Association, and the Australian Sugar Producers Association, to overturn the Ingham Byrne order, which mandated the cutting of cane at roughly a 13% discount in terms of wages. This offset, which covered the cost of the lower price paid for burnt cane by the mills, was the level demanded by the industry. I'll just finalise matters by drawing attention to this photograph. It was, as you see, it was mounted as a postcard. It's dated 14th of July 1928, so it's after the South Johnston, historic South Johnston dispute. This gentleman here was the one I mentioned a couple of times, Francesco Fantin. Fantin led a very active life from being a teenage paramilitary in Italy to trying to mobilise opinion inside Loveday internment camp 14A against fascism, for which service he was murdered by the fascists in 1942. Now, I mentioned Fantin's paramilitary activities. This gentleman here is a Mr. Panizzon, Gaetano Panizzon. He served in Italy's Libya War, and that turned him from being a Catholic to an anarchist. And he's mentioned by the perpetrator of the largest anarchist terrorist attack in Italian history as the man who supplied the explosives. I have my doubts that he knew what the explosives were going to eventually be used for. He probably thought that they were going to be used generally for workers' defence, things like placing charges in factories where the Carabinieri might intervene or the fascists might intervene. So that's just a... I thought those... They look just like a fairly typical cane gang, but you have to remember that all the workers in these images had stories, and that's just two of them.
Thanks for listening to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. If you'd like to find out more about the Society, its various branches and labour history in general, then please visit www.labourhistory.org.au.
Find me there. for me where fountains spray. You'll not find me there, my beloved, where tears flow. For me, where birds sing, you'll not find me there, my beloved. I am a slave where chains ring. There is my resting place. Don't look for me where birds sing. You'll not find me there. And if you'll have me with certainty, so come to me, my beloved. And take the so there's not enough food to grow. Why does it have to be so? There's not enough food to grow to feed those hungry children. Why is it for us and not for them? We love to fill our guts up. We always want one more cup. To fill our guts up, we always want one more cup. No deep thoughts to want to share the plenty we have to spare. It's time that we learn to give so that their young can live. It's time that we learn to give so their young ones can live. We'll be right back. that suffering, I'll turn to be offering. Heart's loaded with suffering, I'll turn to be offering. Are we so shallow and tight because their skins are not white? What's with you politicians making all the wrong decisions? What's with you politicians making all the wrong decisions? Spending our money on war when you could feed people poor. They need a word of warning. We'll see one faithful morning. We got to open our doors.
By myself, I never need no one. name